Well, thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. And Shui Lan's was always has always been a great support in our in our work. He's told me today that I should try and speak for maybe 30 minutes or you know, maximum 40 minutes. I'm reminded of something that Pedro Malan, the former Brazilian finance minister, said when he was given a certain amount of time to speak, 30 or 40 minutes. And the question is, how can I possibly tell these people everything that I know if I only have 40 minutes to talk to you? And his wife and my wife would say, it's very simple. Speak very slowly. So I will, for those of you whose first language is not English, I will try and speak slowly. So, generally speaking, when you talk to anybody about in China about the G20, and the context this year is the decision that will be made very soon on the presidency of the G20 for the year 2016. This year, the presidency is Australia, and they're organizing the meeting, which will take place first week of November. And the decision's already been taken. Turkey is the president for 2015. And there's a system that's been derived from how the G20 finance ministers choose the chair of the process. The chair, the presidency of the group, this informal group, changes every year. And the presidency for 2016 will be either China, Japan, or Indonesia. And the very strong likelihood is that it will be China. And if it is China, then there's also an element of the G20 process called the Troika, where the past, current, and future presidency are supposed to work on organizing the meeting. So what may happen is that in 6 months' time, in November, at the Australian G20 summit meeting in Brisbane, the decision will be made on the chair to follow Turkey. And China will then realize, oh my, it's not very long before it's our year, and we're in the Troika and have responsibilities for organizing. So two things usually happen when you mention the G20, or when I mention the G20 to any Chinese colleagues. The first is, oh no, China follows. China's not going to lead anything. And the second concern is, well, what would the U.S. think? The U.S. wouldn't like it. So generally speaking, the reaction to the notion that the G20 should be a high priority for Chinese leadership, there's a general prejudice against it. So what I wanted to talk about today is to make a couple of arguments. First, I think we can argue quite persuasively that continued, sustained global economic growth, stability, is helped if you have a strong and effective G20. I think that's an argument that few people would disagree with. We don't have any substitute forum. In Pittsburgh years ago, the G20 was announced, the G20 leaders at the time in Pittsburgh announced that was going to be the premier international economic forum. The G7 can't do it. The G8 hardly exists anymore since the Ukraine problem. There's no other steering group. There's no other agenda-setting group. So continued growth in China requires stable economic conditions worldwide and ideally prosperity worldwide. The second point I want to make is that the G20 is in some trouble, and that its future effectiveness, its future relevance, will depend on the leadership, and China is very likely to be the leader following Turkey for the year 2016. The dilemma is that many people remember an aphorism or some advice from Deng Xiaoping about what foreign policy should be, and I'll come back to that. I want to dispute that, argue that the time is, that he gave that advice, it was very appropriate advice, but it no longer is applies. And then finally, I'll want to make several suggestions about if China were to take over the G20 and actually lead it, what procedural changes have to be made in terms of the G20 process for preparing meetings and for taking decisions, and what substantive suggestions in terms of policy could we make. But I want to underline that in being sort of optimistic, I'm not naive, that there are a lot of very difficult constraints that face any G20 host. If you've seen any photographs of G20 summit meetings, you'll realize that nothing can be decided at that meeting because there are 55 people around the table. Anybody who's an expert in decision making will tell you that, you know, you've got to have a smaller group. So what the G20 has is a preparatory process. It's called the Sherpa process. A couple of years ago, the Mexicans really made a very significant strategic error. They split the process in two. They split it into a Sherpa process and a finance deputies process. By chance, in Moscow, a year ago, December, I walked into the Sherpa meeting, and I guess the ushers didn't realize that the many badges that I had didn't entitle me to be in that particular meeting. I was with something called the Think 20, where the Russians had invited people from think tanks in the 20 G20 and G20 countries to come and meet down the hall. When I walked in, I was astonished at what a Sherpa meeting looks like to prepare, because there were three, the inner table was much a bigger square than this, and there were two other tables around it, three concentric groups. There were over 100 people in the room. 10 international organizations were present, so it's clear that not much can happen. No decision's going to be taken there. So we've got big procedural problems. Even if the leaders would take the time to make these decisions, they don't have the technical expertise. You know, especially since we're dealing with finance issues, many of the presidents and prime ministers that are present at the meeting did not go through the routes. They did not ascend to their position by first being finance minister. So many of the financial issues or economic issues are beyond them. The expectations are totally unrealistic. You know, there's thousands of media accredited. There's tremendous pressure. Something has to be produced. It's almost it's unrealistic. Civil society provides all kinds of pressure. Excluded countries want to be there. There's virtually no time. You know, these meetings last for a day and a half. The meetings are supposed to be informal. There's no compliance mechanism. You know, there's no sanctions. There's no legal follow-up for anything. And you can't make any decision without consensus. So it's a really difficult problem. So I, in undertaking leadership, which I'm going to suggest later, I just want to underline the point that it's a, to a large extent, an overconstrained problem. And this is reflected to a large extent by the severest critics of the politicians, which are the editorial cartoonists. In every country there are editorial cartoons, and let me give you a sample of some of them. This is at the time of the Pittsburgh summit, how the editorialists characterized the G20. By the way, anybody who wants any of these slides, you can just come up to me afterwards. And I'm happy to send you, and I'll email you a copy so you can have the slides, no problem. So this is an American one back in Pittsburgh, 2009, and that was a relatively successful one. This is an Indian editorial cartoonist characterizing their view of the consensus and the meeting of minds. This is Gordon Brown after Pittsburgh, probably the most most successful of the G20 meetings, and this is what the, how the editorial cartoonists sort of made fun of him. I'm just making the point that the proponents for action on the G20 are going to have to explain to the leaders that if they try and provide some leadership, they have to have this expectation unless they're extraordinarily clever and successful. This is a Mexican one. For those of you who don't know Spanish, mañana means tomorrow. At the time of the Mexican G20, the year before Russia, a couple of years ago, the euro crisis was the critical issue. And this is your Luo Ji, who's for graduate students, I always recommend you should look in the Cartoon Bank, Google Luo Ji. He's the cartoonist. He does brilliant stuff, and he's probably got a good cartoon for virtually every political theme that you might be writing about. So this is a very large stack of things that the karate experts have to break, and it's not going to be simple. So what did Deng Xiaoping say? Now I'll come back to this. I've been chastised by Ambassador Wu Jianmin, former ambassador of China to France, that this translation is not correct, and we'll come back to that. This seems to, he didn't like the word hide, you know, but I'll come back to it. But the basic point, which has really had extensive influence, I believe, in China, is the notion that China should never claim leadership in multilateral affairs. This is the legacy of Deng Xiaoping. So my argument is that continued growth rates in China of well over 6-7% is really necessary for social stability and for all kinds of reasons that it's critical to maintain high growth rates. The domestic challenges just require that growth. So I wish we were able to to sit down with Deng Xiaoping and ask him, what would he advise today? Does he still advise that China should not claim leadership? So this basically is, I think, the logic of the argument. If you don't have a stable, rules-based global market, then you're not going to get the economic growth that you need. The only way to get the growth is to have that kind of stability, to have the rules clear. That permits the investments that are required, the international investments that are required. And you're not going to get that from any other informal group other than the G20. I think China has very specific national interests that it has to defend. Over time, I think the yuan, the renminbi, has to become an international reserve currency for all kinds of selfish interests for China. I think the Chinese, like any other financial industry, wants better international regulation of financial derivatives. It's clear that the international financial institutions, which were created, you know, just after World War II, they're 70 years old. Generally, 70 years old, you retire. If you can't retire, at least you should be reformed. And something has to be done about agricultural subsidies in developed countries. And then we're going to have to somehow come to some sort of peaceful resolution on international disputes, especially with respect to undersea resources. And where are you going to get these things? Where is this defense going to take place? Not in Washington at the IMF or World Bank, not in New York at the United Nations. The most likely place is around the table of the G20. The reality is that the last 4 years have not done the concept of the G20 any good. There's a large literature that denigrates the efforts of the G20. They haven't been able to come through on the IMF reform. The work on inefficient fossil fuel subsidies is very, very slow. I think their greatest advance has been on lowering the cost of international remittances. You know, there's just not been much progress. I don't see any alternative. The Americans, by the way, when anybody says, what will the U.S. think, you have to ask yourself, which U.S.? Because the U.S. is not a single homogeneous intelligence. There's not a single entity. The U.S. is a hodgepodge of conflicting interests. And I don't see the stalemate in the U.S. government changing any time in the next 4 years or so. So I think you could argue quite logically that the future relevance of the G20 is not going to be determined, any improvement in the relevance of the G20 is not going to be determined by the Americans. It's not going to be determined by the Europeans, especially with what's going on these days in terms of EU elections. It looks like there are more people who want to break up the European Union than to strengthen it. So if there's going to be any increase, any improvement in relevance, it's going to have to come, I believe, from Chinese leadership. So the scholar Wang Yizhu said this. So my premise is that the role of research institutions and think tanks and scholars is to find the win-win options on the multilateral stage. everything doesn't have to be conceived as a zero-sum game. Many of the issues, especially when international growth and international investment is involved, involve positive-sum games. Last September, State Councillor made this very encouraging, to me anyway, comment. It's the first official comment that sort of belied Deng Xiaoping's advice. One of the nice things about giving a presentation is you can pick and choose your quotations. So even Deng Xiaoping said something quite helpful to my point. And then in terms of the definition of hiding capacities and the question as to whether or not the translation works. So even Wu Jianmin believes that you can still keep a low profile, but that doesn't mean that you don't lead. It's a question of attitude. It's a question of the approach you take. It's a question of whether the degree of arrogance in which you propose your ideas. So there is a potentially a Chinese way that can actually be the antithesis of how some people characterize an American approach, which is, you know, you just lay your cards on a table and this is the way it's got to be. There are other ways to proceed. So what I'd like to do is presume that the Chinese government, Chinese leadership, decide that, yes, they're going to try and make something of the G20. What would they do? So my argument is that there are a series of reforms that should be done with respect to the G20 process to make it work, to make it efficient. And then I have a couple of substantive suggestions that I would make. These are suggested simply to prod some thought, and ideally ideas will be generated within China about how to improve the process and some substantive policy suggestions to the G20 through its improved preparatory process might proceed with. You have to remember, by the way, what does the G20 do? It's not. It doesn't have an army of bureaucrats to go and implement stuff. Basically, what the G20 does is, when the leaders agree to do something, they agree that they'll go home and in their own governments they'll take a particular approach. Occasionally, if they really don't know how to deal with a problem, and they do this in many, many cases, they commission a report from the appropriate international institution or international organization, or sometimes teams of organizations. They ask the World Bank or they ask the International Energy Agency. If you go through the various communiques, you'll see that they basically establish the research agenda for the whole multilateral system by calling for a report to be delivered at their next meeting. And the other thing that the G20 does is it can create an international institution. They created the Financial Stability Board to deal with financial regulation. So if there's a vacuum in global governance, the biggest one these days is in energy. The only international energy agency is an OECD creature, and China, Russia are not members of the International Energy Agency. Doesn't make sense. We don't have a global institution. The G20 could create an institution. But to do anything, you need to have a process. So the first suggestion is that they have to do something about the Troika. Now, the point here is that all the members of the G20 are equal, except there are two that are more equal than the others. There are two more equal than others. Nothing's going to happen at a G20 meeting of any serious consequence unless both China and the U.S. agree. It's a consensus organization, and unless China and the U.S. are strongly in favor of a reform, it's not going to happen. So rather than try and convince them after the fact, the suggestion is that they should stop this business of the Troika being the preparatory group, having the current, the previous, and the subsequent hosts get together and plan the meeting, change it into an executive committee with five members, and you have each year as a permanent member China and the U.S. in the group. So I think when China becomes president, should they become president in 2016, they should invite the Americans in right at the beginning to help plan the subsequent meeting, and they should actually put pressure on the Turks to do the same sort of thing. Otherwise, you know, the reality is you're just not going to have any process. The other problem is that the G20 is the big show. So every international organization fought to be invited to the preparatory meetings, to the Sherpa meetings, and every head of every major international organization wants to be invited to the summit. Now, you cannot have a real discussion with 40, 50 people around the table. So one of the things, a difficult thing, is to take the international organizations and remove them from the preparatory process. They should be the servants of the countries that are making decisions. We can come back to that. That's going to be contentious, and each international organization is going to really be unhappy if they're disinvited from the preparatory process. But they should be people who are implementing and delivering on the decisions that the G20 take, not making those decisions. The G20 tells them what to do. The other problem is that as soon as the first G20 meeting was held in 2008, President George Bush invited the G20. You know, the difficulty is there's no logical criterion for who to invite around the table. Do you invite the countries with the 20 biggest population? As a Canadian, I say, no. What you do is you argue that you should only invite the people who have the largest territorial landmass. Because otherwise, you know, if we just do population, Canada might not make the cut. But there's no logical way to do it. So what Larry Summers and Paul Martin had decided when they set up the G20 finance ministers was they just did it arbitrarily, and they didn't invite Spain. And Spain and the Netherlands complained bitterly in 2008 and, you know, did démarches diplomatic, put all kinds of diplomatic pressure on to get themselves invited. And then the Africans correctly pointed out, what's going on? You know, there's only one African country in the G20. They were originally going to have Nigeria come, but there were real political difficulties and personal difficulties with the Nigerian leader at the time, so they didn't invite Nigeria. That's why there's 19 countries in the G20, if you count. Paul Martin tells a joke, it's not because it's a rounding error or that finance ministers can't count. It's just Nigeria was originally going to be on the list, and then they didn't put them on. In any case, what we have now is the African Union and NEPAD are invited, and each host invites a regional guest, another country. And, you know, every country wants to be in the room. But the consequence of pandering to this is that you expand the group beyond an efficient size. So I think what has to happen is that China should be really bloody-minded and say no. The other thing that is going on now is that there's a mad effort at outreach. Each G20 presidency is going out there and talking to everybody. There's now a B20, you know, where business gets together. There's a C20 for civil society and NGOs. The one I would keep, of course, is the T20, the think tanks, because we come up with substantive ideas. But there's just too much outreach, and the reality is there's only so many hours in a year to prepare for a meeting, and how much time do you want to spend listening to an endless list of demands of things that should be done? You have to have some faith in the fact that the think tanks of the what I would have the executive committee countries and the presidency have a pretty good idea of what has to be done. I would outsource the outreach, but they have to cut back on outreach and work on just getting agreements on the critical substance of the policies that they want to pursue. And then there's a problem of people put stuff up on the agenda. Well, there should be a new process where if you want something to put on a G20 agenda, you better put together a written justification that explains in very clear terms why it's a positive sum game, what the strategy would be to make it a win-win operation. And if you can't do that in the first place, items shouldn't be considered for the agenda. We have a very poor precedent now. Each host sort of puts a new item on the agenda each year, and the process can't work that way. It's going to topple. And then I have a suggestion that you have to have a non-secretariat. For those of you who know the diplomatic world, there's a concept in diplomacy called a non-paper. If you have an idea for how to resolve a problem, but you don't want your country's name associated with the proposal, you write up the proposal and you submit it to the negotiating group, and it's called a non-paper. So I think what we need is a non-secretariat. Any kind of serious multi-year process requires an institutional memory, and it requires the substantive input from the officials of the other key countries that are helping you organize the process. So what the leaders, without exception, want is to not have a New World Bank or an OECD secretariat where a bunch of international bureaucrats are going to tell them what to do. They want control of the process, and they want to retain the informality. So the way you do that is you just have each country second a couple of officials who are high officials in the administration. So the Chinese should send a few people from the finance ministry, the foreign ministry, to Ankara to work with the Turks on the agenda. When it's in China in 2016, if that's the case, the Turks should be invited. There's precedent for this. The Americans and the Canadians, the UK, the Australians, all invite officials from partner countries to come and work with them to help prepare the meeting. So I think this has to be systematized, maintaining informality. No people are seconded, so they would be paid by their own government. There's no new positions being created, no new organizations, but we can have all of the benefits of a secretariat without any of the problems that would ensue, that the things, the attributes that the leaders do not want. So China should establish this non-secretariat. So on some ideas on the substantive side, I think the Financial Stability Board has to be strengthened dramatically. It's in China's interest to have international financial stability. Nobody nobody profits aside from some hedge fund pirates, you know, from volatility. How can we strengthen it? Give it a legal personality, give it financial autonomy is one of the things I would do. Similarly, there's a tremendous agenda to be done on shadow banking and over-the-counter derivatives regulation. I think on climate change, it's very clear that the current process is broken and has no chance of success. If you think for a second about burden-sharing formulas, once the international community agrees to do something that costs money, there's burden sharing. So think of, you know, just paying the dues at the United Nations. The Americans fought hard to not pay the 28% that they were doing, and they got their dues cut to 22%. Think back to Copenhagen, where the promise was made of, we're going to raise $100 billion a year in climate funds. You know, we created a green climate fund, $100 billion a year. The UN, everybody subscribes. The green climate fund, this $100 billion, everybody is not going to subscribe. Only the rich developing countries are supposed to subscribe. What do you think the prospects are of the US Congress agreeing to pay $30 billion a year to such a fund? Or even the Canadian government, whose bill would be $5 billion a year. So people keep talking about this $100 billion, but it's complete fantasy. It's an Alice in Wonderland fantasy. There's not going to be any financial transfers, but the Indians at every meeting insist that there's going to be new and additional, quote, new and additional, end quote, finance. And then the second thing is legally binding targets on emissions. It's never going to happen. So instead, what we need is, because climate change is a difficult problem, I mean, you're aware of it in finance in China, just in terms of a public health dimension, in terms of you know, what the atmosphere looks like on an average day. So what has to happen is it's got to be bottom up. And the way to do it is we should have an R&D consortium. There are examples of the international community getting together and deciding we're going to work together on a very expensive research and development project. I know of three. The International Space Station, the Large Hadron Collider, the fusion reactor. These things cost billions of dollars. There's not a lot of publicity about it, but there's real cooperative, international cooperation on funding it. The thing about an R&D consortium is that if governments decided that they wanted to pursue it, if China convinced everybody to do it, the institutions don't have to be all in poor countries. Institutions could be in the countries that pay for it. So the U.S. money could stay in the U.S. So I believe there's much greater chance of getting the U.S. to appropriate money if it's going to be spent on salaries to U.S. scientists. The trick is that the results have to be license-free, patent-free, you know, universally available on new research and development. Similarly, on standards, we can have a bottom-up process. The Major Economies Forum is already doing a lot of work. They have to be phased in gradually. And then if China and the U.S. agreed that, okay, the standards are going to be really tough on cement in 2020 or 2022, on aluminum, on power plants, and furthermore, there's going to be border tax adjustments. You know, we're gonna get the WTO to back that up. It could be done. Internet governance is a problem. There's going to be there's a real chance of damage unless a global agreement can be made on it. And then there's an intergovernmental process that started to replace the Millennium Development Goals. I think I characterize it as an impending train wreck. China has a lot of credibility in terms of demonstrating what's the narrative? What's the new narrative? It's not the Washington consensus. What's the new narrative? China has the credentials of having brought hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. What's that new narrative look like? So I think there's a lot of need and hope for that. So what I've done is given you a list of suggestions on the preparatory process, because nothing just happens at these meetings by chance. It has to be prepared over time. There has to be a structure. It's got to be systematic. And there are some ideas. Again, the argument is that China will benefit greatly from an effective G20. And furthermore, the G20 is not likely to be effective unless China actually makes some effort and takes some action. So my last slide, I believe, is the ball's in your court. So I would stop there. I have one other sort of thought, which is whenever you're presented with counterarguments, try and remind people that the perfect is the enemy of the good. The perfect is the enemy of the good.
Okay, thank you, Barry. So.